You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Did he say it? We don't know. John Morton, dying signer of the Declaration, still 4 years from American victory in the Revolution, told his critics, those who thought he was foolish to have voted for independence and to have signed the Declaration of Independence. Tell them that they will live to see the hour when they shall acknowledge it to have been the most glorious service that I have ever rendered my country. It's a great quote, but no one heard it at the time or said anything about it until a century later, more than a century. Man of Finnish, Swedish descent from Pennsylvania who lived about 16 miles from the Capitol, Speaker of the Pennsylvania Assembly for time, deciding state. But its delegates were exactly split with folks like James Wilson and Benjamin Franklin on one side and George Reed and others on the other. It came down to John Morton, who went for independence, thereby putting Pennsylvania in the yay column. Now, Morton was for it originally. He writes to Thomas Powell, a merchant in London, in a 1775 letter, and says this: "You have declared the New England people rebels, and the other provinces aiders and abettors. This is putting the halter about our necks, and we may as well die by the sword as be hanged like rebels. This has made the people desperate." He wrote another letter: "I hope time will manifest to the world that a steady perseverance in the cause of freedom will triumph over all the deep-laid schemes of tyranny." So, yeah, I mean, there's some question there as to whether he said, and it's always, he certainly felt it, and it's certainly conceivable that if people criticized him, he might make a comment, you know, in the last couple of days that somebody recorded that was something like that. We're a little bit past the day of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which was July 4th? No, not exactly. It was signed on August 2nd, 1776. And it was signed, in some cases, by different people than those who had participated in all the debates and in the drafting. For instance, Robert Livingston participated, pushed the issue of independence, served on the committee to help write a Declaration of Independence, but wasn't around for the signing, so did not sign, and therefore didn't become a signer, even though he was very important to what happened July 2nd and 4th, 1776. But then you have the case of Robert Morris and George Reed, two Pennsylvania delegates to the Continental Congress, who did sign, but were opposed to independence during those votes. It should be noted that their state, or at that time their colony of Pennsylvania, did vote yay. And Robert Morris was against independence, but sat out for the final vote, therefore allowing Pennsylvania to go into the yay column, we think on purpose. Here's what a New York Times article from 1981 said about the signers of the Declaration of Independence, which does stand in stark contrast from the sacredness of most presentations of these men. "The 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence form a fascinating cross-section of late 18th century America. Some were great men, some were not. A few were best-known leaders in their states. Others were in Philadelphia because the really powerful local leaders stayed home to form their state governments." That was the real deal. The action was in the states at this time. You have the case of Peyton Randolph, who is very respected, and when there's trouble between the Virginia Assembly, then a colonial assembly, and Lord Dunmore, the British governor, and it's going to be an armed struggle eventually, he returns to Virginia to form a state. Who's picked to replace him? March 1775, Thomas Jefferson. Even Jefferson considered himself a pale comparison at the time to Peyton Randolph. Well, Peyton Randolph would end up dying in 1776 and then would not get well known as one of the founders. So Thomas Jefferson becomes one of the most successful alternates ever. But it's something that's so important because we talk about the signers all the time, and we should. And it's an important document, and the people who signed, you know, put their names on the line. They were important people. They had possibility of great loss. But it is also important to realize that many other people sacrificed. I don't believe there's a signer that fought in the Battle of Concord or Lexington. I could be corrected. There are also some 8,000 Americans imprisoned on British prison ships. And this is something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the textbook version of the history. So there's people who made great sacrifices who were not of the stature of many of the signers of Declaration. Nobody more than me has done. I've done a whole podcast on the signers, which we're going to talk about. But it is important to note that there were many other people who were either in the army or organizing in their own local states where a lot of the action was going on. But it is on August 2nd when most of the people who we see as signers of the Declaration of Independence sign it. Not all. Thomas McKean does not sign until years later. After that signing ceremony, August 2nd, the Declaration was most likely in the office of Charles Thompson. He's another figure. Now, when you look at the engraving of the Declaration of Independence, which you most often see if you get a copy in a store or something like that, it will be just the signature of John Hancock, very large signature, and Charles Thompson. Charles Thompson seems like a small figure, but he's actually very important to the revolutionary movement in Philadelphia. John Adams calls him the Samuel Adams of Philadelphia. He was allied with Benjamin Franklin, and during the crisis over the Stamp Act of 1765, he's very vocal in the opposition to that Stamp Act. His duties were not just limited to doing some clerical work, although he could do that. And he is the one who redoes the Declaration in a nice format, as opposed to the type of handwriting copy you would have in a legislative body with marks and everything in it. But he does more than that. He acted in many cases as the Prime Minister of the United States before there had been such a setup. But there's something else. Thompson is responsible now for that declaration, the original one. And December 12th, 1776, after this has been signed and everyone's excited in August, the British fleet arrives. And threatened by the British, Congress reconvenes from Philadelphia to Baltimore. The first printing of the declaration that goes out has just the signatures of Charles Thompson, the secretary, and John Hancock, the president of the Continental Congress. President of the United States of America in Congress assembled. You have in 1777 the successful battles of Trenton and Princeton, where George Washington surprises the British and beats not only the Hessians, that's that famous Christmas story, right? But also goes on, moves around the British force that came to beat him after Trenton, and defeats a second British force in Princeton. After these two victories, the Congress is in Baltimore and declares that the copies go out now with all the signatures of the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence, and that it be sent to each of the United States, and that they be desired to have the same put on record. The Declaration, the original one, now moves back to Philadelphia and is held there from March to September 1777. After the British threaten Philadelphia and eventually they'll capture it, it moves to Lancaster, Pennsylvania for a day or two. For most of the rest of the year and into 1778, is kept in York, Pennsylvania. It's then moved back to Philadelphia. The Declaration goes where the Continental Congress goes. So in 1783, it's in Princeton, New Jersey, and then it's moved to Annapolis, Maryland for a short time, stays there till 1784, It then goes to Trenton, New Jersey for a short period of time as the very temporary capital of the United States is there for a very short period of time. When Congress moves to New York, this would be the Confederation Congress, the Declaration goes with it. And it's housed in the New York City Hall, the old one. The first Congress under the Constitution of the United States creates a Department of Foreign Affairs and demands that this secretary should have the custody and charge of all records, books, and papers. So now Charles Thompson retires as Secretary of the Congress and surrenders the Declaration. And then in March of 1790, Thomas Jefferson, who had drafted the Declaration of Independence, becomes in charge of keeping it as he becomes Secretary of State. In 1800, under President John Adams, the Declaration is moved from Philadelphia to the new federal capital in Washington, D.C. It travels on a boat down the Delaware River, into the ocean, into Chesapeake Bay, and up the Potomac to Washington. It's housed in one of the few buildings that existed in the early Capitol, and that's the Treasury Department. For a temporary time, it's in the old War Office building. But you have this interesting thing that occurs, and that's in August 1814, the United States is at war with Great Britain. A British fleet is again appearing in American waters on the Chesapeake Bay. Secretary of State James Monroe rides out to see the landing of the British forces and then alerts State Department officials, in particular, a clerk named Stephen Pleasanton. Please purchase coarse linen. Cause it to be made of bags of convenient size in which the gentlemen of the office can pack the precious books and records, including the Declaration. Pleasanton writes his story in 1849. He says, I obtained carts and had them conveyed to a grist mill, then unoccupied, belonging to one Mr. Edgar Patterson, situated a short distance on the Virginia side of the Potomac, beyond the chain bridge, so-called, 2 miles above Georgetown. An armaments foundry was near the mill, and Pleasanton, thinking that the British might destroy it, led his carts west to some farmhouse in Virginia, procured wagons in which the books and the papers were deposited. Then he rode to Leesburg, a distance of 35 miles. So, while the White House and other government buildings were burning, the Declaration was stored 35 miles away, hiding in one person's house. And it's kind of a local mystery. They're not exactly sure which house the Declaration was stored in during this time. But it's somewhere in Leesburg, Virginia. Pleasanton said, an empty house was procured by a Reverend Mr. Littlejohn. The papers were safely placed, the doors were locked, and the keys given to that reverend. Littlejohn was not just a reverend. He served as county sheriff, and as one person described, he could finish a saddle, preside on the bench as a magistrate, preach a funeral sermon, baptize a child, and perform the marriage ceremony all on the same day. And apparently, one night in 1814, he also had the task of protecting this revered American document. There is another account. A Mrs. A.H. Throckmorton differs with Pleasanton. Her story having been recorded later in the 1800s, she says, for one night, they, all the papers, remained in the courthouse here in Leesburg, and then were carried several miles out in the country to the estate of Rokeby, and securely locked within the old vault, and remained out of reach of the enemy for 2 weeks. It's perhaps the area's oldest brick home, built about 1760 for the first clerk of court. It has a vault with iron-barred windows, and it was common for local officials to store county documents in their homes, lacking buildings to do so. Unfortunately, this Miss Throckmorton is somebody that no one knows and wasn't available, is can't be found in the existing county records. So it will remain a little bit of a mystery, but one thing we know is as that flames were seen in the distance in Washington City, the Declaration was safe. It's not until the British had withdrawn their fleet from the Chesapeake Bay and by September 1814 that the Declaration is returned to the national capital. And with the exception of a quick trip in the 1970s to Philadelphia for the centennial, and for safekeeping in Fort Knox during World War II, the Declaration document has remained there since. I'm really pleased to be able to talk today with a longtime listener, Jason Petrie, who, and he and his father and his uncle constructed, and his brother constructed card decks of all the signers. And he sent one to me. I was very pleased to get one of those. The Declaration has a very important symbolic nature, but as you can see in American politics, what any group of words mean is going to be somewhat dependent on who you are and what your politics are. But that cannot be the totality of the truth, I believe. It has a powerful influence towards freedom and has been used in political debates. You know, the fact that that declaration was saved in that house in Leesburg, Virginia, meant that 40 years later, Abraham Lincoln could write to someone who had invited him to a celebration of Thomas Jefferson's birthday in Boston the following: "Your kind note inviting me to attend a festival in Boston on the 13th in honor of the birthday of Thomas Jefferson was duly received. My engagements are such that I cannot attend. Bearing in mind that about 70 years ago, two great political parties, the Republicans and the Federalists, were first formed in this country, and that Thomas Jefferson was the head of one of them, and Boston the headquarters of the other." He's talking about Thomas Jefferson being the headquarters of the Democrat Republicans, and Boston being definitely the capital, if you will, of Federalist Party politics. Lincoln's noting how odd it is that these days, in the 1850s, it is both curious and interesting that those supposed to descend politically from the party opposed to Jefferson should now be celebrating his birthday in their own original seat of empire, while those claiming political descent from him have nearly ceased to breathe his name everywhere. All honor to Jefferson, Lincoln says, the man who, in the concrete pressure of a struggle for national independence by a single people, had the coolness, forecast, and capacity to introduce into a merely revolutionary document an abstract truth, applicable to all men in all times, and so embalm it there, that today and in all coming days it shall be a rebuke and a stumbling block to the very harbingers of reappearing tyranny and oppression. Lincoln was using history to beat up politics, and it wasn't new. He did it his entire career. His famous Cooper Union speech, with many people say is what gave him the presidency, was simply that. He was expressing how the views of the founders, including people like Jefferson, who were slave owners, was tending towards the gradual emancipation, perhaps elimination, of slavery in America, not the way it was going in the 1850s, which seemed like a new set of territories and perhaps all of the terra firma south, where slavery could actually grow. He said of his political opponents, they are the vanguard, the miners, and the sappers of returning despotism, and anchored his statements in the Declaration of Independence. The name, the Republican Party, which is odd because that's the same name that was often used to describe Jefferson's people, but Jefferson is always seen as the symbolic head of the Democratic Party in the United States through history. Still today, you have things like Jefferson-Jackson dinners and the like. But you have to also remember that the Republican Party, starting in the early 1850s in Wisconsin, also decided on that name because they wanted to claim Jefferson as their own in politics, if not in, you know, if you couldn't draw a line between the various politicians involved in the party. In their politics, they felt they were closer to Jefferson. Lincoln certainly did. And he invoked the Declaration as that bulwark.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm very pleased to be joined by Jason Petrie. He is a listener of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and he is a signers of the Declaration buff, if you will. Really glad to have you on, Jason. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bruce. It is my pleasure and honor to be with you for your 15th anniversary.
How long have would you say you've been listening to the show?
I can probably tell you about exactly when it was. I was looking for podcasts about the Declaration of Independence, and I found your They Signed series, which I think you started back in 2012. And there may have been a couple of episodes already on the feed when I started listening, but I got into that pretty early. And then, of course, you mentioned your other podcast, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, at the end of every episode of that podcast. So I subscribed and have been listening ever since.
I happen to work for a place that even well before COVID-19, for financial reasons, got rid of their off. So we were all working at home. And so I had kind of no commute. And I was like, well, let me do something extra. So I was doing the Signers podcast in the meantime there.
It's a really great podcast. I've listened to it several times all the way through. I try to do it once a year around the 4th. And there's always something new that kind of stands out when you hear it for the 3rd or 4th time. And if people haven't listened to that, I'd highly recommend it to any of your regular listeners.
That was the time when there was still this email chain going around about the sacrifice of the signers. And while the sacrifice of the signers was great, I felt that the email chain that was going around was just incorrect in so many ways. That was no longer doing much honor to the signers. And my point was always, there's no reason to exaggerate. We can just actually look at these people as best as we can tell, because there's a little less information about people from the politicians of the 1760s, which are a lot of the people that ended up signing, than there are about some of those signers that were more involved in the Revolution and with the American government thereafter. But, you know, we can find some information, and we can actually salute them for who they are and everything like that. And it grew, and I got really interested in it, and it's fascinating. But at a certain point, I think every podcaster has done this. They try that second podcast, and it's really tough. So we wanted to talk about signers a bit. You were nice enough to send me, and thank you very much for sending to me, Jason, this the Liberty deck, which is something that you worked on, which is a deck of cards, which each card has a signer on it. So would you like to talk just a little bit about that?
Sure. That was really my dad's project, along with his brother, my Uncle Donald, and both of them are no longer with us, unfortunately, but they got the idea back in about late 75, maybe around 76, when the Bicentennial was kicking off. They were both in education, and there was at the time a traveling exhibit that I don't know who was putting it on, the State Department or the Pennsylvania folks, and it included a replica of the inkstand and some candlesticks and a tablecloth and a facsimile of the Declaration of Independence, and they would put it on display in various communities. And while my uncle was looking at it, he had kind of an epiphany where he thought, I said to his brother, how many signers are there? My dad says, well, there's 56. And he says, and how many cards in a deck? And I think he was having one of those brain situations where he expected the answer to be 56. And my dad said, well, 52. So I went, that doesn't work out then. But he asked him what he was thinking about. And he said, well, I'd kind of need to have a deck of cards with each of the signers on there. And they kicked around the idea and said we could have their portraits and when they were born and when they died and their signature at the bottom and a little biography. And then They almost immediately decided in the back of the card we'd recreate John Hancock signing the Declaration of Independence. And so since they had access to this traveling exhibit, they set it up where they put the inkstand out on a table with the Declaration and took some pictures of it. Unfortunately, that was back in the 70s where it was kind of tough to do quality photography, and none of those pictures really turned out. They tried to get the deck put together, but again, it was in the 70s, so that was kind of a project to do. Mm-hmm. We didn't have desktop publishing, and it was a lot harder to research things, and there weren't readily available portraits of all the signers, so they were mocking up a card. They always did Benjamin Franklin, who ended up being the Ace of Hearts, and they would get the picture off a $100 bill and put it on a card and mock that up. And they went through various iterations of that. But when they were looking into getting the manufacturing done and the boxes, it just was not something they were really set up to do. So it didn't really go anywhere in the 70s. Then in the 90s, my brother and I were in law school together, and we were thinking, geez, you know, it's such a shame that nothing ever came of that Liberty Deck idea those guys had. And we realized at the time, you know, we had access to Macintosh computers, and you could print things in color. And we went over to the university library and found a neat old book that was put out by the State Department in 1904 for some reason that presented for the first time a complete gallery of portraits of all the signers of the Declaration of Independence. So we just saw that all this stuff is actually available, and it wouldn't be that hard. So we kind of got them back on the project again, and they actually followed through with it that time and had, I think they had 1,000 decks printed up.
Oh, wow.
Then the issue became selling them. So that was back in the 90s, and they had a website, and we sold a few decks online, but never really much interest. And of course, the obvious thing is to get them into gift shops in Philadelphia and DC. And when we would try to do that, everyone was always really interested in the product, but they also wanted to buy them for 99 cents so they could mark them up to $1.99 and sell them. But the actual cost that we had into each deck was more like $4.75. So that wasn't really a profitable thing. And I think the only way you could have actually done that is to have them manufactured overseas, probably, and greater quantities than we were willing to do. And they were, my uncle and my dad were also very concerned that the Liberty Deck had to be printed and conceived and produced in the United States. And they always wanted to have a cute little thing where at the end it said the former British colonies in America. So because they were stuck on that, it never was something that was really viable. Although through the years we did sell a number of decks, and I think probably the most that they ever sold was at kind of a strange tourist attraction that's in Rapid City, South Dakota. I'm not even sure it's there anymore because they quit buying the decks, but there was a well-to-do gentleman who was fascinated by American history and the Revolution, and he built kind of it's generous to say a replica of Independence Hall. It's a big blocky building that I guess it gives you the impression of Independence Hall. And then inside, they had recreated in life-size mannequins the Trumbull painting of the Committee of Five presenting the Declaration to John Hancock. So it was this three-dimensional room, and you could walk around it and look at it from different angles. And then they had tour guides that would give you some information about some of the people that most people don't know anything about.
Well, that's great. I'm actually looking it up to see if maybe there's any clue if that's still there in Rapid City. I see a building. It might be an older picture. Yeah, I kind of get this sense. It's like it's much bigger. See, you have more space in Rapid City than you do in Philadelphia. So the actual tower, what it's a replica of, is that corner part of the building where the tower is, and at least to my eye on this website, it actually looks like it's actually bigger. But yeah, this they've really done an attempt to really make it look, and it apparently has 47 founding fathers in life-size mannequin form and a Liberty Bell replica. I mean, I think these things are important because not everyone can get to Philadelphia, and I'm on the East Coast, and it's pretty important to remember that not everyone is, which people forget.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, if someone wants to get that experience, they they really, it's good to have at least places where someone can visit that that can do it. Well, hey, let's look at, let's take a look at the deck here. I have the deck of cards that you sent me, and I'm going to do my very poor shuffling here. So yeah, when we look at it, there is, as you say, a picture of the Hancock and the Inkwell. The Inkwell, is there more to say about that?
You know, there's not a whole lot of information about the Inkwell that's mm-hmm. out there. We know who made it mm-hmm. and when it was made and that sort of thing. And that it was used in Philadelphia. It wasn't something that was specifically created for the Continental Congress to use. And they just took advantage of it because it was there. The guy that made it was Philip Singh. I think he was an Irishman, although the name doesn't seem Irish to mm-hmm. me. I think that's correct. And it was used at both the signing of the Declaration and the Constitution, just coincidentally. And then when they moved the Capitol, they took it with them. And it wasn't until, I think, the centennial in 1876 where they put it back in its rightful place at Independence Hall.
And, so that indicates that if they moved it to the Capitol, I guess to Harrisburg, Harris Ferry and then became Harrisburg, that then they probably indicates that this was really the Inkwell of the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah.
And it just, that was the most important thing going on in that building for a lot of people. This was still experimental at the time of the signing. Well, that's wonderful. And it is interesting that there would be this, particular document, and we don't have kings and queens here, and we should be careful about the sacredness to which we apply objects like that. The actual signing, where most of them are signing, I believe is actually the anniversary just passed. We're talking on the 3rd of August, and August 2nd seems to be the date when a bunch of these signers actually got in the room and said, we want to actually affix our names.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of that is that both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, to their death, insisted that they signed it, the copy that's in the National Archives, on the 4th of July. And I think the historical record shows that that's just not correct. And the book that I mentioned earlier that we got that had all the portraits in it has a little section where it talks about that, and it says that the journal of the convention on August 2nd, 1776, says the Declaration of Independence being engrossed and compared at the table was signed by the members. Then it goes on to say, yet it is certain that all did not sign at that time. In fact, Thornton did not attach his signature until November 1776, and Colonel McCamus, Thomas McCain, is authority for the statement that he did not sign it until 1781. Which is 5 years later, which I've always been kind of fascinated by.
Well, I think some of them went right to the army, so some of them were fighting, and they were not able to
leave town right away. Yeah,
to do it. Let me just do this real quick. Here's my lousy shuffling. You won't catch me doing this in Atlantic City, but I just going to the first one. It is George Walton of Georgia.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
A small man who was orphaned when a boy, self-taught man who began as a carpenter, became a lawyer, judge, and U.S. senator. Severely wounded and captured at Savannah, founder of University of Georgia. That is George Walton of Georgia. And, you know, I learned a couple things right from that, or a couple things that are important right from that, is that, first of all, there's this talk that these folks are all rich people that started the revolution and that were signers. And here's a fellow who's a carpenter who self-taught, and there were many ways you could become a lawyer, just studied with somebody, as a lot of these, some of them who actually who were signers did. You just studied with another lawyer and then started hearing cases. And so he doesn't appear to be at least somebody of huge means. Also, the Battle of Savannah, probably one of the underrated Revolutionary War battles. I mean, it wasn't successful, so that's part of the reason why, where the city of Savannah was captured by the British, and an army of Americans and French. It was one of the first French commitments of ground troops tried to retake Savannah, and they tried to retake it from the swamp side, and it was bloody, and they were unsuccessful, and both French soldiers shed blood, and American soldiers shed blood in that. He was severely wounded. So there you have it. That's the first one I pulled out, was George Walton.
And George Walton, I'll tell you, the dilemma that my dad and my uncle had was mm-hmm. what to do with the four extra people. So they were going to put mm-hmm. two of them on jokers, and they ended up having four on jokers, and they thought it was just disrespectful to call them jokers. So they called the four extra ones the Patriots, and George Walton is one of those.
I'll just do one more quick one, then I'll have just a question about your favorite signer, unless we happen upon it. Boy, this is, I tell you, no dealer would tolerate this kind of horrible shuffling. Two of spades is Joseph Hughes of North Carolina. And the card says, Quaker-born shipping merchant, first head of U.S. Navy, and credited with getting John Paul Jones his first command. Fiance died young. Broken-hearted Hughes never married. One of two bachelor signers, and not one of them that commonly rolls off the tongue. Any standard review of the signers of the Declaration must start with the man who signed the largest, John Hancock. And that is why I will not begin with him. Oh, he deserves praise, and we'll get to him, but instead I ask you to picture a man desperately clinging to the rudder of a sailing vessel as it speeds up the Atlantic Ocean. His hands are occupied, so he can't wave. He relies on his voice to signal to his fellow passengers his distress. As he shouts, he hopes to be heard above the ocean foam. Sea travel was not smooth or safe in the time of the founding of America. On the high seas, an overcrowded British vessel going from the British colony in St. Augustine, Florida, to the city of Philadelphia, Thomas Heywood, was jerked from the deck and fell into the water. Pronounced Heywood, though it appears Heyward on the declaration that he signed, he was being released as part of a prisoner exchange and was about to get his freedom. Now, his life was in peril. This was not a punishment devised by the British dunking him in water, although some of the authorities might have wanted to do that. It was an accident, yet indirectly resulted from the captivity he suffered. Men from the boat looked around for him, feared he was deep in the sea. They were soon alerted to the ship's bow. Heywood was using a voice that he hadn't been using during most of his famous contribution to history. He seldom spoke during the congressional session. He was a moderate. He didn't want independence at first. He wanted some form of protest against Great Britain's treatment of Americans, maybe some appeal to other nations, but hopefully reconciliation with the king. He would come to change his mind and side with the patriot cause, with the independent cause. When the British attacked and captured the main city of his state in 1780, Heywood was taken prisoner, and the British would plunder his plantation. The British made no distinction between reluctant signers and enthusiastic ones. And the British had another reason to single him out. Heywood was appointed the judge of the criminal courts of the new state government. He was presiding at the trial of people who had conducted treasonable correspondence with the British Army, which was in the vicinity of Charleston. Judge Heywood condemned the people who had conducted the correspondence,
and ordered their execution, and ordered it to take place within view of the enemy. This served, along with the signing of the Declaration, to make him a special target for the British. Yet Hayward was treated as a prisoner of war and, thankfully, due to a prisoner exchange, escaped the noose. He was rescued from the rudder, too, and he would live to see the Constitution of the United States passed and his fellow signer, Thomas Jefferson, become president. He died in 1809. Thomas Lynch, Jr., it appears, was not so lucky with his voyage. He hadn't been on that ship, the ship that Hayward was on. He wasn't captured, as three of his fellow South Carolinian signers were. But he was on another voyage made perilous by the war. Lynch was one of the youngest signers of the Declaration at 26 years old, and he wasn't supposed to be there. His father, Thomas Lynch Sr., was supposed to be the signer. Lynch's father was ill, and Lynch wanted to see him, but even for this extenuating circumstances, he could not get leave from his militia company in South Carolina. Election to Congress was one of the ways his fellow South Carolinian friends could get him to Philadelphia to see his father and still in an honorable way. Sadly, despite Lynch's youth, he himself was sickly, as his father was. He would suffer from some kind of fever, perhaps an infection unknown in that day, nausea, hot flashes, sweats. He would often find it difficult to work through the sessions. His absence may have been okay with some of the independence faction, though. Benjamin Rush felt he was a man of moderate talents and timid in difficult circumstances of his country. But in his moderation, he was no different than his father's position, who he thought, entering the Congress, to replace his father, he should emulate. Without modern medical knowledge, it was felt that a change of climate might help in the view of Thomas Lynch Jr.'s physicians and friends. Presented the only hope of his recovery, maybe the south of France. But a voyage to Europe was at that time hazardous on account of the exposure to capture. There was, however, a boat that was proceeding to a Caribbean island and then, with his wife on board, would go to France. It was a circuitous route through a very different route that the British weren't likely to find. He embarked, as did his wife, and days passed, weeks. No one heard from Lynch Jr. No one heard from his wife, nor any of the ship's passengers. Months passed, and he was presumed lost at sea. Let me ask you, Jason, do you have a particular favorite signer?
I thought that was kind of interesting, because when you contacted me by email a while ago and you suggested that we'd maybe talk about some signers, you listed three of them that always were probably in my top 10.
Oh, there you go.
I didn't know how you knew that. John Hart, and some of these were always my favorites and my brother's favorites just because of what ended up getting on the card. And what we always enjoyed about John Hart was that he spent the war in the countryside living like an animal. And that's he's actually the first signer that you talk about in your podcast. They signed, it's The Man in the Cave.
Yeah, I talked about it. I wanted to. It was so important for so many reasons. One, there's a little Jersey patriotism, Bruce Springsteen, apple pie, Taylor Ham, if you will. And John Hart is kind of our uncelebrated signer. In December 1776, an elderly man huddled in a cave. It was not far from his home, but just far enough away from the hostile troopers that were rummaging through the area, who had seized his farm and sacked his mill house. He cringes with any leaf rustle, stick snap, or hoof in the distance. Is it his patriot friends bringing him food? Is it former neighbors, now loyalists, opposed to independence for the American states, seeking to betray his position? Or is it the sound of the redcoats coming to put him in chains? Anyone who came upon the sight of this man, huddled in blankets, freezing cold, might not have realized that he was the founder of a new nation, who had, just months before, affixed his name to its founding document, the one we know as the Declaration of Independence. On first glance,
we all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance Podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress. Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire. Enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty. And about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today. And join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
John Hart may not appear to be one of the great gentry who had committed his property, his honor, and now it seemed clear, his person, to a nation that for the moment existed only on that parchment and not yet in the world of diplomacy. Yet America did exist in the minds of many of his neighbors, the mill workers, militiamen, the farmers, outspoken clergy, and everyday mechanics and hands, who all across the English-speaking part of the North American continent were casting away the seal of the king with great enthusiasm. Yet this sudden cave dweller was not just a declaration signer and member of the new Continental Congress. He was the highest officer of the legislative body of his former colony, now a state, the Speaker of the Assembly of New Jersey. That body was still meeting where he could sneak out and muster enough hidden assemblymen of the fledging new state. He still led New Jersey and chaired the Committee of Public Safety for the state's defense.
But there were a couple other reasons. One, once again, is a person that I would say middle class, not hurting for money, a miller, and a miller at that time is somebody who would have had connections with people. Anyone who was a miller, like George Washington, for instance, knew the local farmers that would come and bring grain. It was a kind of social network in addition to being a moneymaker. And so I think he just had a reputation, too, for being honest, for treating the Baptist minority in the state of New Jersey well. And really adhering to that American value of religious freedom. He's somebody who sacrificed, and I talked about that in the beginning, that he was huddled and hiding, but not what this, like, some of the emails that had gone around had said, that he, like, you know, they say he's in a dog kennel, when actually it was a cave, and that cave, this cave still exists. And, I mean, maybe a dog lives there. At times, you might put a dog there, but it's certainly not a dog house. It's a cave, and he was hiding from British troops that were looking for him.
You also had mentioned Stephen Hopkins, which everybody likes him. He's always pictured wearing a hat. In the Trumbull painting, he's wearing a hat. Even indoors, he wore a hat. And he was the signer that had severe palsy. So his signature is very shaky. And there's a quote, and this is one of the problems with researching and getting information about the signers, is you find these quotes and there's five different versions of it. And sometimes, obviously, it's cleaned up to be a little more dramatic. But he said something along the lines of, although my hand trembles, my heart is firm. And there's questions about whether he steadied his own hand or whether John Adams helped him. And I think that's an interesting story about the signers. And it also goes to illustrate the point that a lot of these pieces of information we have about the signing are apocryphal. Mm-hmm. They don't show up for 20 or 30 or 40 years until after the event, and people are gone and there's no way to verify it. And it just ends up being the kind of stuff that gets in an email and sent around. And next thing you know, people know these things, but they aren't necessarily true.
It's also pretty clear to me that the significance of the event, especially the real sacredness of it,
It was important. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been read by Washington troops. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been something that all of these people decided, whoa, we actually have to all sign this, not just like let the president of Congress sign it and let it be engraved and the like. We have to all sign it. So it was important, and I know it got around and everything. But on the other hand, I also think that you see in this the reason some of these stories are apocryphal and made up is that not everything was recorded. They didn't know the importance. Was it going to work? Was it going to, it was a very protracted war for independence. British ships were on their way when this whole thing was happening. And, you know, there was also probably a lot of different feelings about the men who were sent down there, like a bunch of politicians. You know, it wasn't the universal pride in the colonies for all of the people that were in Philadelphia in that room. And so I think to some extent you later people came and wrote histories and made up stories. But Hopkins, I believe, is interesting because all we see the signers, all we see of them is through their signatures. And because the signature has that distinctive, particular weakness, it kind of embodies that sacrifice in a way. He did live for a few, you know, more years. It wasn't like he just died the next year or something like that. I think what's interesting about the other thing that's interesting about Hopkins is this rivalry that he has with Samuel Ward. He's Rhode Island. Samuel Ward's Rhode Island. They're both running for governor at different times. And this is all before there's a United States. So we had politics, folks, before there was United States, and it was intense, and it was a rivalry. And Ward represented Newport and maybe the richer elites of Rhode Island, and Stephen Hopkins represented the Providence and the growing kind of middle class, working class that were had property and were able to vote at that time. And you know, it was a very severe rivalry, and you get this sense that through the 1750s they're kind of battling, each one thinking they can win and run state politics in Rhode Island and be governor. And it starts to become clear somewhere around 1760 or so that they both realize they're really at parity, and that Hopkins isn't going to win this battle being the leader of Providence, and Ward isn't going to win this battle being the political leader of Newport. And they decide to, there's this exchange of letters where they're not sure who wins the election at the end. And then Hopkins says, maybe we should just consider another candidate for governor. And then Ward offers him the deputy governor spot. And neither one knew the other one wrote a letter. That never happens. But a few years later, when Hopkins wins the gubernatorial election, he basically says to Ward, let's just come up with a compromise candidate and have that person be governor. And then they're friends and they're together in the revolutionary cause. So it's an interesting story of early partisan politics in one of the states, and also a coming together in the fight against the Stamp Act and the events leading up to the revolution.
I agree with that. And I think going back to your point about how it was an important event, but it probably wasn't viewed the same way at the time as we tend to view it, is illustrated by the fact that we think of the Declaration of Independence, and it's in the rotunda of the National Archives and the big elaborate nuclear bomb proof display case in the Charters of Freedoms rotunda. But for years, the Declaration of Independence wasn't revered like that. It hung on the wall in the patent office for years, and it's mostly the damage that was done to it was because it was hanging in direct sunlight. And I think it's interesting there is something written on the back of the Declaration of Independence, which is not a secret map or anything. It's just somebody labeled it Original Declaration of Independence 1776, as though that might be something that you wouldn't be aware of if you were handling the document. And the 1904 book that we have shows a a picture of the case where the declaration is kept. So I don't think it was even on public display in the early 1900s, and that's something that's certainly changed since then.
And Stephen Hopkins is, in your deck of cards, one of the Patriot cards, and there he is with his hat, very much revered in the state of Rhode Island. And the other one that I mentioned was Button Gwinnett. First thing is, you could be very wealthy if you have that signature.
That's right. There were only something like 50 known examples of his signature, because he was fairly obscure until right at the time of the Revolutionary War, and he didn't live long after. He had another one of those rivalries where he was the governor of Georgia, and his arch rival was General McIntosh, and they had kind of an ill-conceived adventure invading East Florida, which was controlled by the British at the time. It didn't go well, and they both blamed each other, and then someone ended up challenging the other to a duel, and they fought a duel with pistols at 12 paces, and they both got shot. McIntosh recovered, and Gwinnett did not. So he died in 1777. So he didn't have a lot of opportunities to sign things and create a bunch of signatures and write letters and sign documents. So there's 40 of those signatures, I think, are in public collections in museums or state capital collections. And so there's only 10 of those signatures that are available to be purchased privately. And I think you have to pay a lot of money to get one.
It's notable that McIntosh also was a Continental War officer, and after the duel, Washington had him sent up, like, please come up to the Army again, because he was afraid what might happen if he remained in Georgia there. He might be prosecutor tried, and that he was in Valley Forge the winter of 77 to 78. It's just a shame, of course, that, a signer of the Declaration gets killed over, a kind of a trading of insults and some other political issues, and that it couldn't be resolved, that we weren't just fighting Britain at the time, but there were still intra-state and intra-country politics, and even among those in the Revolution that were leading to duels and things like that. A lot of people believe, well, the beginning of American politics was after we formed a country and maybe the first president. That's certainly not.
People look at what's going on around them today, and they see the politics, and they see the way the media behaves, and they see that there's certain outlets that are very right-wing and others that are left-wing, and we all pull our hair out and think, why isn't everybody neutral like they used to be in the old days? But if you know anything about the old days, it never has been that way. It's always been the same, and it's always fascinating to see you tie those threads together and make sense of everything, and I really appreciate what you do.
Yeah, we'll keep doing this as long as people keep listening. We've got a lot planned. I have a whole thing that I'm working on the 1890s, and I've done two scrapbooks for the Patreon and premium podcasts where I've read the scrapbook, essentially. I'm working on the third. There will be four scrapbooks, and once I have four scrapbooks for the lucky premium and Patreon subscribers, I'll get that into about two episodes. If you actually have to do an episode that's kind of narratived and themed, that'll fit in about two, about the 1890s and the some of the weird events that happened, some of the modernizing of America, things that are still issues today, really got their start back then. Some hot button issues may have not been resolved by any means in the 1890s, but you're starting to see the beginnings of it. And it was a huge time, of course, for politics in that decade, that populism, silver and gold money, tariffs, and big corporations, the beginnings of any kind of progressive era, the regulation of industries, all of that being fought out
in the 1890s. And so we're going to have a nice time at some point. You know, I used to say the summer, and now we're in the summer, so I have to say the fall now to keep pushing it.
I know that we're all looking forward to that, and you've had other listeners on, and I've heard those podcasts, and people have commented on the Dozen Ronald Reagans and the Arc of Commerce. Those are both just fantastic pieces of work, and I believe you have a full-time job. Yeah. I don't know where you find the time to do the research that's required and get those things produced and edited and out for all of us to enjoy. But I have a full-time job, and I can barely find the time to listen to everything that you put out. So I really wish somebody would give you a MacArthur grant or something so you could just dedicate yourself full-time to making more podcasts.
Well, thank you so much, Jason. Much appreciated. And your support's appreciated. And everyone who supports, I'm lucky to have about maybe 50 people on Patreon and maybe about the same amount on this other original channel of the premium. And that helps out so that at minimum, you know, there's no costs that I have to incur for. Those are taken care of, and things like the JSTOR journals, which really help. The fact that JSTOR went to two things have helped me greatly. Google Books, believe it or not, although they're getting more and more restrictive. I can see enough in a Google Book. Because if I had to buy every book, I mean, for all these episodes, you know, I can see enough to get the proof that I need for a statement or to double check a fact or to, you know, get a second source or things, where that's been essential. Public libraries have been essential. My own bookshelves has been essential. The ability of donors so that I can buy books has been essential. And then JSTOR changing to not just allowing kind of the elitist thing of like, you have to be a member of a college or institution to get access to the journals. But about 3 years ago, allowing individuals to pay a fee and just get in, and I have that, which allows journal articles. And that has been invaluable because, you know, the political science journals and the historical journals just can go deeper and answer questions that people really have. This is a kind of crazy thing. A lot of the questions that are burning that people have about politics and history are answered in journals, probably Presidential Studies Quarterly or the Mississippi Valley Historical Association from 1962 or 1946 answered these questions, but we have to dig to find it. And I'm always amazed at what someone has written an article on. Or I like to go diagonal, use a biography which isn't intending, if you're reading a book that's about the question you're trying to answer, you have the possibility of bias because that author has an agenda, even if they're nice about it, even if they're trying not to. But if you're reading something diagonally where it's like, say, a biography, and you just happen to read a factoid that is related to your research question, that's very useful. And a lot of those journal articles, there might not be a journal article on the specific thing that I'm looking for, but you may pick up something in the course of, you know, in another journal article. Was there one in the latest deregulation airline cast? Let me think about that. I think something came up where tried to find, you know, the usual suspects, try to find if anybody had any memoirs, but Carter didn't talk about it. So there'll be something like a question that's open. So Senator Kennedy helped out. This great liberal senator helped out with this great somewhat, you know, libertarian or conservative issue of airline deregulation. So the real question that people have is, yeah, but this is kind of some kind of fluke. Did he really care? You really want to be in this? Or did he just happen upon this issue? There might be a little of that. But the one thing that I found is that when he gives his speech, so then you go to the episode we did in the 1980 DNC convention podcast, and when Kennedy gives his speech, "The Dream Will Never Die," I find that he's proud to cite his deregulation bills as among his accomplishments. That's a speech where he's taken a free shot at goal. He's not going to get the nomination. He wants to rally the troops. He could have said anything. So you kind of get the sense that's really what you care about, and he mentions it there. So you find diagonal ways to kind of prove your point or get more purchase on what you're
looking for. I do have a full-time job. It's not even a small one. It drives me crazy sometimes how I do it. I just try to, you know, I have to limit a lot of my reading to history. I have to read like a grad student, meaning I have to read indexes and then read the passages. I can't always read whole books like sometimes I would like to. It's a little easier to read whole books when I'm doing one of those things like the Reagan or the Arc of Commerce. And I put it together, and I don't come out with episodes every week like a lot of podcasters. And I, you know, I'm not trying to cry, but I paid a little price for that over the years. I do think that the professional podcasting industry that's there now is really bent on, you got to come out with content like every week. But thank you for your comments and all of that. I really appreciate the patronage of it. The only thing I'll add to that is I really do pine for a point at which I will be able to do this more and offer more content. And, you know, that could be coming. I mean, I do have advertising on the cast. I have recently joined the Airwave Media Network. That is still not, you know, a full-time type thing. You know, the audience would have to be, you know, larger for advertising to really work. But there's some, you know, there are, you know, if consistent advertising happens, a lot more opens up. So there is the possibility, and I will definitely probably be looking like 2022, 2023 to have more of like, yeah, you know, maybe I'll do a telethon or something like Free Bruce, you know, so that I can do more, so I can have more content. Because even if I could only do it for a small period, I want to build the content well so it can be used later. Oh, what the heck? Let's pull one more here. So this is the Eight of Hearts. The Eight of Hearts is James Smith of Pennsylvania. Yes, we like him. He's the militia man. Irish man who came to America when 10 years old. Lawyer who spent years on the frontier as a change of pace from the law. Colonel in local militia. Much of his life a mystery since fire destroyed his papers. I love that idea of like living in the frontier as a change of pace from the law. As a lawyer, do you ever feel like running away?
You know, I do. It's actually been a very strange year. I just went back to court last Monday for the first time since March of 2020. Once the pandemic hit, we started doing everything over Zoom or something, and it really hasn't been the same. There's a lack of interaction with people and the camaraderie you feel with the other attorneys and meeting people up at the courthouse. All that's been gone. So I'm really hoping to get a little closer back to normal sometime soon.
Yeah, no, and I hope the same. It's really, I've just recently been able to venture out. The lockdown's been good for working on a podcast. It's been slightly bad for podcast audiences. So has the proliferation of, you know, Dolly Parton, Bruce Springsteen, and Obama, every Soprano cast member having their own podcast, even though they're immensely good. And I listen to a lot of other podcasts, but that competition takes a little bite out. And then people not on long commutes anymore. I'm sure there are people telling me, Bruce, I'm really looking forward to listening to your next eight podcasts when I drive again or go on the road. So all of that. So it's good that hopefully we can have some normalcy and, you know, get back to things. But
I was just going to say, I don't have much of a commute. It's 15 or 20 minutes. I live in a different town than I work. But I will let you know that there have been a number of times where NPR has something they call driveway stories, where you get home and you're in the driveway and the story is so good that you finish listening to it. I have a lot of episodes of your podcast that are just parking lot stories. I get to the office and I can see that there's still 20 minutes left, but I'll just sit in the car and finish it off before I go into the office. So,
well, I mean, that's the way it's got to be told in history stories. And I guess there's just, it happens naturally for me. It is written, and there is a script for both episodes. Some are script mixture. I've gone to a hybrid recently, but I don't just wing it, and I don't do a strict like Mike Duncan type script either. somewhere in between. Do you pay a low price for that too? There are some people that like this scripted stuff. So, but I also just find like, wow, find some great stories. The stories tell, there really is some interesting events that have happened. The episode that became Don't Run for President just came out of, let me find every funny campaign story that I can. And then I realized how often it had to do with people not wanting to run for president, though people were forcing them, or just running so badly that they really weren't running. Or Stephen Douglas, who basically, you know, tried to run, but you weren't supposed to run in 1860. So when he actually campaigned, he got in trouble. So there was all these little, like, you know, stories. So I'm really glad to hear all that. And Jason, thanks so much for coming on.
And thank you, Bruce.
Heck of a first day for George Taylor, one of the Pennsylvania signers of the Declaration of Independence. He wasn't there on July 2nd. When the resolution for independence was passed, nor was he there on July 4th. He was appointed to Congress July 20th, and so one of his first acts was to sign the Declaration. The opening happened because before the vote for independence, five of Pennsylvania's delegates who were loyalists were forced to resign and replaced by others, including Taylor. But Taylor only serves in that Continental Congress that signed the Declaration for 1 year. And why? Because he's not renominated to Congress in 1707 because he runs the Pennsylvania Executive, which was a plural executive, meaning more like a council. He was running that. And that is a very important duty, to be running the states. And so we don't see in the signers a complete document of maybe the best people in the colonies at the time, because some of them were running their states. Taylor plays a very important role as the owner of a foundry. And one of the important limitations that caused the revolution, among a lot of other things, was the Iron Act, which limited the amount of iron that could be produced in the United States in the opening of new foundries. Taylor had one of them, and of course produced cannon shot for the Continental Army, a very important purpose. He dies before the Battle of Yorktown, February 23rd, 1781. One of several signers to not make it through the Revolutionary War, to not know what the document they signed led to.